Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, and I want to welcome to the studio Finn Mackesy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Finn is our permaculture man that we bring in every 4 weeks for chats. And at the moment, we've been going through the design principles of permaculture as stated by David Holmgren.
Hmm.
And what's the book called?
Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability.
There we go. That's a bit of a Bible for people, I imagine, in some ways.
Yeah, the word Bible always
I know, as soon as I said that, I saw you twitch slightly.
But yeah, I mean, that's the first place in where the 12 permaculture design principles were articulated. So it is a bit of a reference, and he's reviewed and updated it since then. So that was originally a 2002 publication.
Has he changed his mind about anything or just refined?
It's more about refinement, I think.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to look at the design principle of use and value renewable resources and services today. So I immediately thought of Extreme Zero Waste.
Yep.
Which was the purpose. And they were, for people who don't know, permaculture was a huge influence on getting that organization together. So,
yeah. I've recently been doing a research project looking at the fuck-up of permaculture in New Zealand. So looking at all these different threads and the different things that came together. And, been interested to discover that a range of different projects that came out of the permaculture movement here in Whangaroa, and particularly that group of people who coalesced around doing a permaculture design certificate in, when was it, 1999?
Yes.
And and Brian Innes and Joe Pearsall came to teach that course, and the participants kind of chose a lot of the curriculum, and they knew what they wanted to learn, get out of it, and that became a catalyst for developing the concept of extreme zero waste further.
So, but one of the things we were just discussing off the air, of course, is me especially, who's kind of quite reasonably well wrapped up in extreme, or have a strong association with extreme. There's more to it than I don't want to let that define the boundaries of what this means. So,
absolutely.
do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, maybe zooming out a little bit, there is a principle that we will get to very soon called produce no waste. And there, all the principles, design principles, you know, there's a degree of kind of integration and overlap between them. But in some ways, and we've already talked about extreme zero waste in relation to some of the other principles, but that might be an opportunity to deeper dive into extreme zero waste. Whereas for me, use and value renewable resources and services is more about kind of going with the flow. So the each principle has an English whakatoki, or a proverb, an adage associated with it. And this one is, let nature take its course. And, and again, I think kind of going with the flow is actually a really good secondary phrase, because it really is about working with nature and working with natural flows. So if we use the language of modern economics, we can think of, so what we're talking about here is more about income than it is about capital assets. And so if a capital asset is, or using the language of systems, stocks and flows. And so we have this, so what would be a good example is, if we're thinking about a forest, the forest itself is like a stock or a capital asset. It's built up over time, and it's the resource or the wealth that allows the system to maintain its health. And the income, or in this case, the flow, would be the excess things that don't degrade from the whole system, but are energy. So you get a big storm come through, and you have some windfall, and some trees come out from, they fall over from wind.
Yeah.
So you extract those from the system and use those for, whatever it is, building Waco or building a house or any number of things. You know, you could use them for building furniture, et cetera, et cetera. That's like a flow, because it's kind of naturally come out of the system. Whereas if we're thinking about cutting down the forest or taking out, healthy trees, then we're actually diminishing the forest, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Can I leap in?
Of course.
Some might be thinking this, that when you take the windfall trees out, that you're, because they rot down and they become home to all
absolutely.
Sorts of life as well.
Yep, absolutely.
So do you don't take all the trees, or do you return the trees when at the end of the life of whatever you're doing? Like, that's
yes, and so that is a good point, because you do need natural breakdown, and you do need those materials to cycle within. So generally, forest systems accrue, they build up material nutrients over time, and maybe less so here on the West Coast, but I'm thinking more on the East Coast and in places like Australia, there is, for the health and well-being of the whole forest, there is benefit in removing surplus carbon, which is also known as fuel in terms of wildfires. And so in this case, you wouldn't want to be thinking about taking all the fallen stuff as just surplus, but generally when we're thinking about using and valuing renewable resources and services, we are thinking about what's surplus to the health of the system that can be taken out. And sometimes actually removing something from the system can keep it healthy for longer. You know, for example, we know that a well-kept fruit tree, or not even fruit tree, you know, in England and in mainland Europe, you have coppice woodlots, so trees that have been coppiced for hundreds of years that last three times, four times the length of a kind of a wild tree, as it were, that hasn't been maintained, and it'll naturally come to its end of life. So there are ways in which you can increase the health and the longevity of a system or a living organism just by selectively harvesting and interacting with it. So I don't know if I've quite answered your question.
Well, I have another possible answer, which is in technologically primitive cultures where people lived in a village in a forest, then everything, they would cut down a tree to build shelter, and eventually that tree would go back into the forest and rot down.
And the whole village would make a decision about which tree to harvest.
Yeah, and there was that too. Yeah, there was a lot, the culture was better integrated with the living world as well.
Yeah.
But with primitive technology, it's much easier to just insert yourself into the cycle but not actually break the cycle.
Yeah.
Whereas in modern technology, we might have to manually go around and collect our old bits of wood and, you know, find out or collect something to bring fertility back to the forest.
Yeah, and to bring it back in. So so in hindsight, maybe my tree fall example wasn't necessarily the best.
Sorry, but it does raise, because that's the one that people always think about, and then there's it is worth discussing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so I guess, but the key idea here is that we're taking the income or the surplus is what we're using, not the stock or the asset
itself.
Right, okay.
That's the point you're trying to make. Yeah.
Is that we don't want to diminish the health of the living system, but we're taking the surplus from it and trying to use that surplus to live off.
And the living system is not so fragile that we can't take something from it.
No, of course not. That's how living systems work, right? There's always an inputs and outputs or exchanges throughout the system.
And abundance. It seems to work on a principle of abundance.
Yep.
I always love the one about if you look at a fruit tree and the blossoms on it, like that tree only needs one successful seed to replace itself. Yeah. So why thousands of blossoms, you know?
Yeah.
And that's because nature works on...
And hundreds of fruit.
Yeah, that's nature it. Works on principles of abundance, which our culture doesn't, or our society doesn't.
And so we can think of examples of renewable resources in this way. So things like plant-based medicines or, you know, rongo Māori are... Sorry, so we need to compare in that example. So we have pharmaceuticals on the one hand, and we have plant-based medicines on the other. And not all plant-based medicines are, I'd say all rongoā are locally available, typically, you know, or at least across the motu. But, you know, you can imagine in a traditional sense is local hapū, iwi, whānau would use local medicines. You know, they wouldn't rely on things that only grew
in Northland.
Yeah, that's it, right?
Yeah.
Unless they were in Northland. Whereas pharmaceuticals are hugely energy intensive. And I'm not comparing, I'm not saying they're necessarily, you know, there's a degree of comparing apples and oranges in this situation.
Yeah.
But in general terms is, I think there's a societal reliance on high energy inputs to maintain our health when we could actually go for much lower energy inputs that are much more renewable and actually provide a whole bunch of other benefits in terms of things like connection to nature and understanding where our health and well-being comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example for me of thinking about this principle. Whereas, you know, pharmaceuticals, and there are some life-saving pharmaceuticals out there, so I'm not questioning that. But when you think that, generally speaking, pharmaceuticals are not sustainable. You know, they work for us now for a whole range of reasons, but we won't, the amount of energy and resource that goes into producing pharmaceuticals is actually quite astronomical.
And you're not just talking about the fact that it all might be made in somewhere else around the world, like in China, probably.
Actually, most pharmaceuticals, I think, are made in Puerto Rico. 60%, something like that. A very high percentage of the world's pharmaceuticals are in a small island in the Caribbean.
That's really floored me. Well, I'm really fascinated by that, but I don't want to sidetrack because I've already sidetracked us once. My point being that it's certainly not made locally. So how much of that that cost is just transport, and how much of it is using lots of resources to make the medicine itself?
Yeah, well, so there's multiple levels of transport too, as you probably appreciate.
Okay,
so the,
yeah.
Materials need to move to get to the manufacturing plants, and then they need to, once they're produced, then they need to be distributed globally. So there is...
But is that transportation the bulk of the cost?
Generally not. Running of labs is very expensive.
Okay.
As well. So you have all the kind of, the costs of manufacturing.
Because I was thinking, in a sensible world, you could centralize the ingenuity and the research. Mm. That is fine. Mm. And then just send out instructions on
the production.
Decentralize the production, and that would solve a lot of the problem.
Mm. Well, I think there's also an element too of doing more, I guess, analysis and comparison of what are the pharmaceuticals that are needed and don't have plant-based equivalents, or where, you know, for whatever reason, certain people or populations don't respond to a plant-based alternative. And then how do we prioritize those things? Because, you know, there are some amazing pharmaceuticals out there, but for the majority of us, I think we just use what's easy, as opposed to and again, the easiness is that's kind of, it's subsidized, right? Because it's not easy from a use and value renewable resources and services point of view. It's easy because it's off a shelf, or, you know, we
have a fantastic system delivering it to our door, basically. Well, yeah, almost our door.
But again, that isn't renewable and it isn't sustainable. And
yeah. So, but it could be rationalized to a huge degree if the cost to the planet is factored into its production, I guess.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And so from a permaculture design principle, this principle is really about aiming to make the best use of renewable resources to manage and maintain yields. So it's about trying to, so how do we maintain our health and well-being in this example?
Yeah.
Well, one of those would be to, you know, set up local stills. So we have local high-quality alcohol, and we can make tinctures and things like that. So then we take our local plant medicines, and that's local livelihoods for people. It's makes the creation of local medicines sustainable over long
We should chat to Bruno from Workshop Brewery about, he always likes a new idea.
Yeah, nice.
yeah, with some stills for pure alcohol.
Yeah, well, again, quite a useful thing, you know, from a medicine point of view, you know.
Yeah.
Good for surgery, good for tinctures, and yeah, you can do a whole range of things with. Yes, so that's one thing, right? And you can make alcohols from a whole range of things. So that would be another example of when we get to that point where we're at risk of, we're in danger of falling food from too much overproduction of fruit trees in summer, in autumn, then looking at, you know, turning that excess produce into things like high-value alcohols and things like that is, again, another example of use and value renewable resources and services, as opposed to importing all this stuff from everywhere else.
All this stuff seems very complex and complicated because our world is so complicated, and so much of this high-energy approach is so embedded in everything we do.
Yeah, and we do take it for granted. Like, it literally is, you know, it's kind of crazy for me, but the idea that we have unsustainable and non-renewable resources and services literally on tap and at the flick of a switch means that we don't have to think about it.
Yeah. Well, it takes considerable effort to think about it and actually to find out. You know, like you can't analyze the switch or the tap.
No.
To figure out whether
it's pretty
what's
abstract.
Happening at the other end.
Yeah, you gotta work pretty hard to figure out, that's right, where a source is. So we want to redesign systems in which functions have become dependent on non-renewable and unsustainable resource use. And so most of our way of life now is designed on that, is that most of the things have become unsustainable, and we have very little choice about that. And that's where you were saying, I think where talking about extreme is useful is there's an attempt there of trying to take a lot of that unsustainable practice and relocalize it and control resource streams and flows.
Yeah.
But thinking about things, and again, this is hard to do, but when we're thinking about transport as an example, so when we look at the car, we have the inefficiency of the combustion engine, but then we have the inefficiency of trying to push a large, heavy object over a surface or over ground, and the road is made smooth. But, that's not only unsustainable because it requires a fossil resource, a non-renewable resource, but it's just really inefficient. Whereas you'd imagine, humans on a bicycle. And again, we can talk about the non-renewable components of bicycles, but generally speaking is they can move themselves through renewable services, in the form of kinetic energy, humans eating food, using that energy and moving ourselves. But also horses, similarly is we can, this is how we did things before we had the car. But even think about transport on water, and again, moving back to a different era in Aotearoa, when the waterways were the highways and how people moved around, but the efficiency of taking a paddle and paddling a waka through a river body, is so much more efficient than, not for the driver of the car, because they just have to put pressure on the gas.
Yeah,
but I've heard people describe, we kind of try to get a sense of how sustainable a car is. And if you want to get a clear sense of the energy required to move a car, just push the car to your destination.
Just push it, he says.
So that gives you a starting point of an understanding of the energy required. But then you have to account for the inefficiency of the combustion engine. So, which works at about 40%. So then you need to push it there and halfway back again to make up for that inefficiency of the fuel transfer to acceleration. And then I think you have to push it there and maybe back again one more time to make up for some other inefficiencies in associated with kind of friction. And so, just trying to make a point about, we take it for granted because, again, it's in our day-to-day lives that we just, of course, we're going to drive everywhere. But
I have noticed it because I walk to work and back home again. I know, and I see all the cars driving past, and I think there's people doing a quick trip, and they've taken that great big metal box with them on the way.
Yeah,
and I'm like, and I'm not pointing the finger because later on in the day I'll use the car as well for the exact same trip.
I do it too.
Yeah, but it's. If you walk around long enough, it does start to dawn on you that we are carrying these huge metal boxes with us everywhere we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're carrying us, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's mostly out of, I guess, convenience because we can.
Yeah.
But you could imagine how unsustainable it is.
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't matter if we're talking about e-vehicles, they're heavier and the amount of materials required to, the mining boggles the mind what's required to make an EV vehicle. And it's still, So again, I guess I'm using this as an example to compare an example of a renewable service versus an unrenewable one.
Give us a renewable one then.
Well, so I guess a bike is pretty close to that, or a walk is pretty close to that. And so we're taking a renewal.
Is a bike close to it, or is it just seem close because cars are so incredibly inefficient? And if we got it, if we evolved to a society where there were only bikes, we might start looking at that and going, actually, these bikes are now the least renewable efficient system we've got.
Well, it depends on how deep of a rabbit hole we want to go down, but I think that's a really interesting question because, you know, bikes are as efficient as they are is because we build our roads, and we build our roads out of non-renewable resources, you know, of asphalt and all the rest of it. Bikes become a lot less efficient. Still efficient, but if your roads are not paved, et cetera, anymore, and then you have, you know, all the metal components in the bike and the most of the components from bicycles are mined and manufactured. So there's all of those elements to it. But the efficiency of, you know, you put humans on a bike and we're kind of off the charts in terms of the amount of energy we spend for the distance we travel.
Right, yeah. And that's a key component of this calculation.
There is that. But it is also comes back to that kind of renewable, non-renewable. And I know there's some interesting work being done all around the world in terms of trying to create bicycle frames with more renewable materials.
Like bamboo.
Yeah.
I don't know why that popped into my head. But it is.
Yeah, yeah. Bamboo is a common one that people are using.
Yeah. Visually, it's obvious, right? You're going to replace the pipes on the bike with something the same shape. That's the easiest way to do it.
But there is still a whole bunch of things associated with the bicycle that do require, you know, reasonably high-tech manufacturing. So, so if your question is a bike really that renewable, both as a resource and so the service, I guess, of moving on a bicycle, I think we can tick that box. You know, humans cranking, you know, pushing on a pedal and moving. You know, we could do that if we were fit enough, you know, and had enough food to recharge every day and move where we needed to go quite conveniently. The actual technology associated with the bike itself, there's probably some more question marks associated with that. A horse, I'd say we could definitely tick that box in both directions in terms of moving around. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of logistical challenges, and I'm aware of, you know, some of the issues that led to the automobile to begin with in terms of the issues associated with
the outputs.
Yeah, the outputs and, and you know, sick and dying animals in the streets, you know, and horses back in the urban days. So, you know, there are challenges to be considered there. I guess the waka, and particularly one used for coastal and inland travel, we can tick boxes on both fronts there. That's certainly a renewable resource in terms of being able to cut a tree, and another one will replace it so long as we're not everyone is having a I guess that's the other thing too, is travel back in the day in those contexts wasn't typically not everyone had their own waka, right? So they were used in more of a communal space. And so, you know, not everyone needed their own tree to cut down to provide their own personal vehicle. And so as we start to explore this principle, I mean, what I think is interesting is when we look at our lifestyles and the way we live our lives, what are the actions we can take to have to move towards a more renewable, a more sustainable lifestyle? And, you know, this is an example where traveling around by Waco today is probably not that viable, right? Because it would require a whole bunch of things to shift, including our sense of the freedom to be able to move wherever we want, whenever we move, would be compromised because there would be a lot more coordination required.
So we saw a waka being used for the burial of King Suheitia. But that's like a ceremonial use and a hugely significant ceremony that happens once a generation.
Yep.
So it's not really a good example at all in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, what is a good example is showing how quickly they were able to move from Nauru Owhyhee. You know, it didn't take that long, really, to get from Nauru Owhyhee up to Taupiri. And, so I don't
know. Also, that like the marae is on the water and the burial ground is right by the water,
no
too.
No remote coincidence there.
Yeah, of course, because that's pre-European.
So settlements used to be built around water. And again, water's great at transporting things, right?
Yeah.
And so there is a lot to be said about that kind of that idea of lock-in. You know, we've built a lot of our society and our infrastructure around non-renewable resources and services.
Yeah, well, and the river's great until you go to the next dam as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I guess that's where portages come in, and there are ways, you know, we're able to build fish passage into a lot of our urban infrastructure. What might the equivalent be for human passage? But again, these require significant societal shifts.
Yeah, this seems like the hardest one of all the design principles we've talked about.
When we're talking about transport, but I think there's a lot of other things we can talk about.
I wanted to bring it back to your property.
Yeah.
And have your permaculture paradise kind of situation.
Yeah,
you probably don't call it that, but...
No, I don't. But
how do you...
Well, so I guess an example for me...
Because you've got more control over...
At that level. Local and hyper-local scale, that's exactly it. And so, I mean... I do quite like this idea of a solar drying device or a solar clothes dryer as a really good example. And, you know, people might either say, what the heck's he talking about?
Or it's a rock in the sun.
yeah. But we're talking about a clothesline, right?
Yeah.
And so that idea of it's a renewable service, you know, versus a... And the reason we use that language is because using electrical clothes dryers are so ubiquitous that you know, need to compare it to that. And so, you know, we need a whole bunch of imported materials, you know, fairly high-tech design for a modern clothes dryer. We need electricity to power it and run it. We need water input, water output, et cetera, you know, more water output. And... we compare that to hanging our clothes in the sun. And I can hear people say, yeah, but what do you do in winter? You know, so there are limitations and challenges, but we can actually build our...
Well, no, we've been drying our clothes all winter at our house.
Yeah, it's, most people do. But I think the assumption is that you can't do that because it's too wet.
I know there are other countries in the world where they don't actually use clotheslines.
There are lots. Yeah.
Yeah, like is the US one of them? I mean, you're from Canada. They're still using clothes. Last time I was in Canada, I saw clotheslines.
Yep. So they are very uncommon and also often seen. So some of that, I think, is about societal norms, too. It's seen as a bit
lower class. Are we going there?
Yeah, something like that. There's maybe not class potentially, but also just quaint, like old fashioned.
Yeah.
And so the idea of working with nature's flows and going, oh, the sun is shining today. Why would I bother wasting electricity when I can actually just put stuff outside? And here in Whangaroa, I mean, most of the time our clothes don't dry by the sun. They dry by the wind, you know?
Yeah, especially at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all good.
And so, you know, that's an example for me of a renewable service is, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that sits in that appropriate technology space, and it does require a change in mindset and a change in planning. But, you know, we could cook in, you know, from, depending on the season, from late spring all the way through into, you know, mid even to late autumn with things like solar cookers, you know, and so we can harvest the sun during the day when the sun is shining and make food. We don't need to, and I'm not saying all this stuff needs to happen, but this design principle is about trying to think about how do we work with natural flows and deepen our connection with the natural world around us. How do we reintegrate ourselves back into natural systems? And this principle for me is, like you said, kind of quite challenging in many ways, but it's about a mindset in many other ways because there's several small things we can do. So that idea of, you know, just using human labor versus automation and... you know, how do we, you know, even things like composting and worm farming is a great way of working with nature services, is how do we break down nutrients and feed them back into our systems. Right now we have a process of, you know, nationally of flushing our human waste into their oceans, you know, and there's a little bit more to it than that. In some places there's more to it than that. In other places, not much more
not
to it than
that. Not much at all. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's those kind of aspects. And then when we're talking about things like natural or renewable services, we're talking about, you know, how
actually,
do we...
Actually, can I just step there?
Yeah.
Just knowing what I know about council stuff, the amount of money, proportion of our rates going to the wastewater, purely
totally.
The wastewater...
Infrastructure generally.
Yeah, not stormwater or our water supply, but just the wastewater is hugely substantial. It is the biggest single item on the list by far.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
And when you think of... and then
which
you,
is a sign of its inefficiency as a process. Yeah.
And its vulnerability, because it requires, you know, our economy therefore requires growth to be able to not kind of service slash maintain that quite high-tech infrastructure.
But
so what happens in a recession and your rates aren't increasing and your maintenance bill is?
Well, we're reaching that crossover point where the rise in standards of treating the wastewater is coming now up against our ability to pay for it. And that's part of it's that specific issue has not really been fully... Not a lot of people in the media have made that connection, but that's a large part of the problem we're dealing with all the three waters argument we're having at the moment.
And one of the things I think you've done nicely that I haven't set this up is, why is this principle important anyway? And I think it does come back to that, is the more we can work within the context of nature and how nature works, the less of these kind of challenges we have. Because, you know, there's surges and pulses, and right now we're energy abundant. But again, we can't keep living off the asset. We can't keep living off the stock in the way that we are. And so there's going to be a point at which things have to change. And if we have all of these unsustainable practices built into our individual livelihoods, as well as at that kind of community and societal scale, you know, things aren't going to go so well. So,
and again, that's literally where we are. We've been living off the work done a generation ago on our wastewater. And now some councils are like, I mean, Whakatane District Council said, we're going to follow the rules at this point, but in the future we simply will not have the capacity to keep doing this.
And again, this isn't a slag at councils, because they're up in a hard place, right?
The system's built stuck. They're between a rock and a hard place.
That's it. And so the more, from my point of view anyway, the more us as individuals can decentralize and take a burden off some of these larger infrastructures, and some of us have more of a choice than others around that, then the more pressure we take off the whole system.
There is huge capacity to make improvements there, because, I mean, the first mistake is putting poo in the water.
I would agree. There's also,
technically speaking, it creates huge issues that you didn't have.
Well, you have two contaminants now, not... Yeah.
Yeah, so you know.
Yeah.
And then you have to take it somewhere, so there's huge, huge piping network, and you've got to supply water, so there's huge water network. And they're currently building a multi-million dollar plant. I've seen it up at the site.
Yep.
And it's going to produce water that would be pretty much drinkable at the end of it.
Yep.
So it's a fantastic piece of technology,
yep.
All because we put our poo in the water in our houses and flush it away.
So David Holmgren, this is years ago, I heard him say, centralized sewage has never worked. It will never work. The quicker we abandon it, the better off we all are.
It's so embedded, because there's so many people, especially around here, talking about composting toilets and why can't we have those in houses. Yep. And council's terrified of that.
Totally.
And for reasons of liability.
And I get that. I understand. Yeah. So there are, but also because, you know, we've been made to fear natural processes so much too. You know,
of course. Yeah. And that's part of the problem. Like, no one will want to buy, well, not many people will want to buy a house with a composting toilet. The percentage of people who want that for that reason is huge. And that's part of, yeah.
And so I think what we're highlighting here is, you know, the barriers. You know, we're locked into an unsustainable, non-renewable service infrastructure that supports our day-to-day lives. And so this design principle is about really trying to explore what are those, in some ways, simple acts that we can do that allow us to start valuing renewable resources and services and start using them in ways that, you know, might make a difference, in a tangible difference in our lives. Might be really subtle to begin with, but I find the more I think about this principle and the more I apply it, the more easier it is to then take on the next challenge.
I think it's such a challenge. I don't want to call it a new principle, because it's the principle of how the planet works, but it's new to us. It's new to us living now in this culture. Very, very new and hard to embed in our lives.
Yep.
And I think you've got to look for the low-hanging fruit. So they're putting you... washing out on the line, like hand washing your clothes, hard work,
yep,
putting your washing out on the line, minimal work.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I never feel like, oh, I wish I had a dryer when I'm taking 3 minutes to hang the clothes out.
Yep.
In fact, I've got some waiting for me. It'll be washed when I get home to hang out. So, yeah.
Yep, and I think that is a good example. I notice a lot of people will say, oh, you know, yeah, I think we have a tendency to, and this is, you know, a fairly natural thing to do when you're awash in energy, but we'll use the easiest technology or the most convenient way of doing things.
It's convenience.
Not necessarily the most renewable or the most kind of ecologically responsive. And so it's a tricky one. But I guess, yeah, one of the things I was keen to explore is, you know, how can we adapt our lifestyle, our daily habits and our practices to align more with nature's flows? And some of that is even just simple things like, you know, this is Raglan. So, you know, surfing and kite surfing and kayaking are all sports or recreation that work with renewable services. You know, yeah. The waves are still... The waves are there.
Yes, they're impervious to our attempts to flatten them by surfing.
That's it. You know, the water's there. So all of this stuff we can do day in, day out. But even, you know, things like, I don't know, like really simple things like using house plants to help regulate localized climate, you know, inside environments to increase the health of, indoor atmosphere is, you know, a really simple one. But we're reducing the need for things like air conditioning units, you know, draft animals, pets even is a kind of a weird one. But
draft animals?
Yeah, so draft animals. So basically instead of using a tractor, you know, like these days we have like 300 horsepower tractors and stuff, you know, that literally means the equivalent of the power of 300 horses. And depending on what you're doing, you might need that, but that's industrial agriculture. But what if we're using... animals to plow a field. And I'm not suggesting that plowing fields is, again, the most sustainable way of growing food. But maybe a better example, and not even draft animals, but using pigs or chickens to scratch up or to go into areas, you know, use them as essentially plows, and they prepare the soil before. And it's easy enough to do.
Yeah, see, now that's those two, the comparison is interesting because using a bullock to plow a field...
Hmm.
That's not convenient.
Hmm.
You've got to look after the animal, and you've got you can't just switch off the engine and walk away. No. Whereas the pigs and chickens, you fence the chickens in under the fruit trees, and it renews and prepares the soil, and you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
In fact, it's easier than using a machine, and that's where permaculture is on a winner for me.
Yeah,
is when you see those kind of solutions.
Yeah, and see people working.
Because we got exactly that. We've had that at our place. We bought a property with that. The soil was horrendous.
Yeah.
It really was. Some things just wouldn't grow. There was always bare patches in the grass even.
And so you're using natural processes to...
And we had these two fruit trees that we planted outside the dining room, and they just, each year the leaves would come, but they just would not grow. They wouldn't get any bigger.
Yeah.
And then one year we fenced and put a temporary fence around, put the chickens in. Yeah. It's away, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like magic.
So,
and doing that manually by, I don't know, going to a garden center and trying to figure out what the right things were to put on the soil and how to put it in, that would have been so much harder.
Yep. And so, again, that's a great example. How do we think about those kind of opportunities across a range of different areas? How do we work with those natural flows?
Yeah.
And bring in, you know, biological... I mean, for me, the worm farming and the hot composting and things are really good examples of things like that too. You know, we have this waste product called food scraps and organic waste. And typically we export that, you know, that goes away somewhere. And then we import compost from somewhere else to keep our nutrients going. Well, it's not that hard really to run a worm farm. Not in my experience, you know, it requires a degree of maintenance, but it's pretty simple. And a hot compost is, you know, a bit hard to build. It takes effort to build it, but once you've built it, it kind of does its own thing.
We've got the, I don't want to call it the halfway solution, but a much better solution in that Extreme does the hot composting for us.
Sure.
Does a really good job.
Yep.
And when we're already up at Extreme, we can pick up some stuff for our garden there.
And that's good, because I guess that's that next scale, right? So there's the things we could do or do at a home scale, and then there's, I guess, the neighborhood scale, and then there's the community scale. And the things that we can't do at the household scale, can we do at the neighborhood scale? And things we can't do at the neighborhood scale, can we do at the community scale?
There's kind of, yeah, there's like a village scale that needs to be there, because I think, because like, I don't do the gardening. That's like my wife's the one who loves that and has always done that. But she's really busy now with her job, and we don't, like, we haven't had a compost for a while because that required a lot of attention. And I was thinking if we lived in some kind of village scenario,
well, that would
with
be
a group of like, I don't know, 10 households sharing a piece of land, then there would be some people who would that's what they'd want to do.
Yeah, yeah. Or and they, and the they would keep, bee. Then they would the working keep, bee comes yeah. in. And,
but like a hot compost, you need to actually know what you're doing and maintain it a little bit. So, and you, as an individual, as a family of four or two or whatever on your site, it's hard to do all those things.
Yep.
And it's not so much that you need to farm it out, it's that as people designed, as beings designed to live in community, that's where the solution lies, is in community.
Yep.
Yeah.
And again, in that sense, is that kind of community willingness to collaborate and work together and support is also a renewable service, right? You know, it's social capital, and you kind of need to use it to keep it alive.
Yeah. No, we'll just do that. I guess we're kind of at the end, aren't we, I think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's, we could keep going, but I think we've talked about a lot of the key points about this principle, and hopefully we've started to explore how we can start thinking about using this design principle in our lives and acknowledge the inherent challenges. You know, we are very much locked into a society that has designed itself around non-renewable and unsustainable resources and services. Yeah. So, you know, there's a journey, you know, individually and collectively, but I think we either can be proactive and try to integrate this into our lives to increase our health and well-being now, or get to a stage at a societal level where the unsustainable practices kind of play out their natural conclusion, and we have to find ways of doing this stuff ourselves again.
And then the crisis will motivate us. Yeah. Folks, we'll be talking to Finn Mackesy. He's our local permaculture man. Well, he's not the only man who does permaculture.
There's lots of us.
Yeah, yeah. Finn gets very nervous when I put him up there. so we're talking about the design principle originated with David Holmgren, one of the founders of permaculture. It's use and value renewable resources and services. And this feels like the biggest challenge, this one in particular. I don't know if it's just the mindset I was in today, but it does feel like it.
Yeah. Well, our system, again, is designed in contradiction to this. So there's a long path ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.